This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby.
Your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans. And its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Breaking news. It was really hot in Canby a few days ago. Fortunately, a welcome wave of cool marine air from the Oregon coast washed over the Willamette Valley Monday evening, shattering the heat dome and bringing a surprisingly rapid end to the staggeringly high temperatures that had ravaged the area for three straight days. As of 8:30 p.m., the temperature in North Canby was 83.7, exactly 30 degrees cooler than the record-setting 113.7 that a Wi-Fi-enabled ambient temperature sensor registered there only 3.5 hours earlier. At almost the exact same time, the National Weather Service was officially recording Monday's high of 116, the hottest temperature ever registered at the Portland International Airport, which began reporting in 1940. Of course, many gauges recorded much higher temperatures in Canby, from the Aurora Fire Chief's dashboard thermometer registering a toasty 118 to DirectLink's time and temperature line 503-266-TIME, which was cheerfully reporting absurdly high readings all weekend. Canby High School canceled all summer athletic activities due to astronomically high thermal readings on the school's turf field and tracks, registering from 178 degrees up to a demented 187. Many businesses and offices, particularly restaurants, shut down early or stayed closed altogether out of concern for staff and customers. The Canby Fire District, meanwhile, stayed busy throughout the crisis, responding to over 50 emergency medical calls in a 48-hour period, many of them related to the sweltering heat. Meanwhile, the mercury at the Whiskey Hill store in Hubbard topped out at 120 degrees, not because it was only 120, but because that was the highest that the thermometer would go. According to meteorologists, the area experienced what's known as a heat dome, which is not, as I initially suspected, the Thunderdome fighting style to the death between Oregonians and the sun itself. Instead, a heat dome is essentially a mountain of hot air stacked vertically through the atmosphere, which explains why it felt like the entire weight of Mount Hood was upon you whenever you walked outside. The intensity of a heat dome is measured by how thick the atmosphere is at a given spot. The hotter the air in the column, the larger the thickness of the air in that column, because heat expands. Climate scientists say the heat dome affecting the Pacific Northwest this week registers a statistical standard deviation from the average 4.4, which in layman's terms means the odds of such an event occurring are about 1 in 10,000, or a 0.01% chance. What cannot be ignored is that these sweltering temperatures are being experienced by a region and a population largely unaccustomed to dealing with extreme heat. Many homes do not have central cooling or even air conditioning units, and many people are ill-prepared to cope with triple-digit thermometer readings for days at a time. This was something that struck transplant resident Sarah Spencer Culkins immediately back when she first moved to the area. I remember when I was moving to Oregon, I noted that none of the apartments I was looking at, even large modern company managed complexes, had central air conditioning, only heat, she recalled. I asked my ex about it and he said that you really don't need AC in Oregon because it's only hot like 2 weeks out of the year. What he didn't mention was that during those couple of weeks, the entire area pitches itself directly into the center of the sun, with the wet, boggy, volcanic ground storing every snick of heat. It doesn't actually cool off until like 2 a.m. Cambyites weathered the heat storm as best they could Sunday and Monday, seeking shade, water, and cool air whenever it could be found. Some took their summer fun elsewhere, heading to nearby lakes or even the coast in search of more bearable climates. Others turned to culinary delights for relief. Whether they were curative, ice cream, popsicles, root beer floats were popular, or for the sake of science. While several Cambie residents attempted the classic cook an egg on the sidewalk experiment with varying degrees of success, local YouTuber Steve Weldon took it a step further, attempting to bake a tray of chocolate chip cookies on the dashboard of his Toyota Prius. They were all right, he concluded. Others made the most of the historic occasion. The largest ever Cambie contingent attended the Oregon State High School Clay Target League Championships in Hillsboro this weekend and added new meaning to the phrase hot shooting, finishing first in the league play. Aurora caterer Arlene Anderson of Arlene Cuisine was there with their usual event menu, pulled pork mac and cheese chili dogs, and over 200 pounds of ice. It really was 108 degrees most of the time. But we were prepared with lots of ice, water, and extra fans. We sounded like a wild party, reminding each other, drink, drink, she said with a laugh. Dripping cooling towels in ice and water helped a lot. Most local fire districts and officials are pleading with residents to forgo the use of fireworks in celebrating the 4th of July this weekend due to extreme temperatures and other conditions that have turned the region into a tinderbox. The Cambie Fire District is one of the first agencies to ask citizens to celebrate their independence without pyrotechnics Monday afternoon, with the area still in the grips of a suffocating and historic heat wave. The fire district is extremely concerned with the extreme hot weather the Cambie area has had the past 2 weeks, Cambie Fire Chief Jim Davis said. Fire danger is high and with very low humidity, and this will cause fires to increase in size very rapidly. The small spark will ignite vegetation and structures. A number of communities, including Portland, Bend, and Eugene, barred the use of all fireworks, including ones normally legal in the state, until after July 4th. Unlike cities, fire districts lack the authority under Oregon law to enact such a ban. On Tuesday, Clackamas Fire and Clackamas County Fire Defense Board issued a joint statement asking Clackamas Countyans to celebrate responsibly in light of the very real risk of wildfire. During this time of prolonged heat and dry conditions overlapping the 4th of July holiday, the risk of hostile fire to occur is significant, officials said. Please consider celebrating the holiday by attending a professional show or in other ways that do not include the use of fireworks. In smaller communities like Cambie, officials were more reticent to ban fireworks, citing various reasons. In a live Facebook video Tuesday afternoon, Molalla Mayor Scott Kaiser Tuesday said he had received numerous messages and even threats from citizens demanding that he impose such a prohibition, but felt it was a matter of personal freedom. Y'all know what to do, he said. I mean, the party I'm going to, we've already said we're not doing fireworks. If you see somebody out there, go put it out. Guys, I'm not here to take your rights away. I'm not here to take your freedoms away. and messaging me and threatening me, it's not going to fix nothing. With the state's coronavirus restrictions set to expire Wednesday, Kaiser and others also acknowledged wanting to make room for residents to enjoy the state's first post-COVID holiday without imposing new mandates. Silverton Mayor Kyle Palmer suggested that a ban in his community might only push displays into more rural areas outside of city limits, where the fire danger would be even greater and emergency responders further away. Much has been taken from us over the past 18 months, and I'm committed to seeing our community find as much normalcy as possible as we exit the restrictions that COVID has caused, Palmer explained. If that includes a family gathering to watch legal Oregon fireworks in a controlled environment, I ask you to be extremely safe and remember that you should do so on a concrete surface or a large board with water on hand. With the devastating wildfires of September 2020 a not-so-distant memory, and the scorching heat wave of this weekend a much more recent one, many area residents seemed eager to follow Kaiser's lead in voluntarily foregoing fireworks until conditions improve. The Canby Rod and Gun Club announced it will not allow fireworks or campfires at a Western Regional Independent Trap Shooting Association event this weekend. Please leave them all at home, Canby Trap Shooting Coach Chuck McClargy said in a Facebook post. Local law enforcement and fire agencies are asking residents not to report the use of legal or illegal fireworks this week, but to call 911 only in the event of a fire or medical emergency. This is normally the busiest time of year for emergency responders and dispatchers without record temperatures, and the heat has proven difficult for the most vulnerable in our communities, Clack fire officials said. Only call 911 to report emergencies. Preventing fires requires collective effort and goes beyond fireworks. Oregon is back and open for business. That was the message at a reopening celebration at Providence Park in Portland Wednesday morning, as Governor Kate Brown hosted healthcare workers, frontline employees, personnel from the state agencies critical to COVID-19 response, state and county leaders, tribal leaders, Oregon National Guard members, housing advocates, farm workers, education, and nonprofit volunteers, thanking them for their service and dedication throughout the pandemic. The event commemorated the lifting of all remaining COVID-19 health and safety restrictions in Oregon, which was effective at 12:01 a.m. Wednesday. That meant all restaurants, bars, gyms, theaters, event venues, and other businesses can reopen at 100% capacity for the first time in 473 days. It also marks the end of the statewide mask mandate in most places, with face coverings still being required only in places like public transit, hospitals, airports, and long-term care facilities. Businesses may have stricter requirements for their customers or employees. Today, we celebrate Oregon's strength, resilience, and collaboration, said Governor Brown. We celebrate brighter days ahead. And today we celebrate that Oregon is 100% open for business. Thank you, Oregon, for everything you've done to look out for one another and to bring us to this day. The event included remarks by Oregon Health Authority Director Patrick Allen, OHSU Infectious Disease Specialist Dr. Judy Guzman Cottrell, Meyer Memorial Trust Chief Investment Officer Ruakaya Adams, and Ricky Gomez, owner of Palomar in Southeast Portland. I look forward to seeing Oregon's restaurants and Main Street businesses flourish as vibrant community cornerstones, the governor said. We are all excited to celebrate the 4th of July holiday this weekend with friends and family. And I smile at the thought of our children going back to the classroom 5 days a week this fall. While acknowledging the historic moment, the state's work is far from over, Brown said. We will be relentless in our efforts to finish the job, closing our equity gaps and reaching every Oregonian with information and vaccines, she said. That means We need to continue this education effort, person to person, neighbor to neighbor. We remain fiercely committed to our efforts to build a more just and equitable and safer and stronger Oregon. There may not be a parade for some of the usual festivities, but don't be surprised if Wade Park in downtown Canby winds up looking and sounding a whole lot like 4th of July this Independence Day anyway. That's because local leaders, business owners, and other groups have banded together to organize a fun musical event on 4th of July to celebrate the Canby community and the nation's independence. We got approached because the city wasn't going to put on a 4th of July celebration, which was different than banning it. It wasn't banned. They just couldn't do it, Canby music owner Brian Haynes explained. So some people contacted me about doing the sound, and I said, I'll do the sound. I'll do live music. I'll do the whole thing. Haynes quickly rallied his usual Canby music team along with past bandmates, students, and other musicians in town and told organizers he would provide tunes throughout the day, free of charge. Other business owners and local leaders joined the charge. Canby Area Chamber Director Kyle Lang began putting together a classic car show to surround the park and make the event more free-flowing and walkable. The Canby Farmers Market, which was already planning to do an expanded Independence Day themed market on Sunday, also lent its support to the festivities. On North Grant Street, the Book Nook will offer a sidewalk sale that day, while neighboring Ebner's Custom Meats will have their barbecue pit fired up for the true 4th of July fashion. We're all putting it together. We're all kind of in charge of our own thing, Haynes said. But yeah, as citizens and business owners, we're going to make 4th of July happen. The occasion is something of a return to the event's roots. As the celebration formerly known as General Canby Days was run by local volunteers from 1982 until 2015, when the organizing committee dissolved and the city took over. Haynes played at the Waite Park Gazebo during General Canby Days for many years. This summer's event will be something of a reunion concert for him. We'll have some people I used to play 4th of July 10 years ago, he said. Before the pandemic, the annual parade and celebration was one of the most well-attended events in the Canby area, drawing record crowds of more than 10,000 in 2019. Haynes and the Canby music team eventually moved on from the stationary stage of Waite Park, preferring to participate in the Independence Parade through North Canby. When we're on the float and we're driving through town, I get to see all these people that I know from town, Haynes said. We're waving to them, playing music, and watching kids dance to it. Everybody's out, everybody's having a good time and enjoying themselves. It's just a great community event. Local singer and songwriter Allie Welchel, a newer employee at Canby Music, will be performing at Independence Day concert for the first time. I always loved coming to the 4th of July. It was such a blast to see everybody come together having a good time and good food, she said. With a laugh, she added, the parade was always my favorite because you get candy, you know. Never too old for candy. Haynes admitted, he was disappointed the parade was not able to happen this year, and not just because of the event itself, it's also because he has a personal Independence Day tradition that he will miss, though his neighbors might not. We set up the float the morning in front of my house because we don't want to leave our equipment out overnight, he explained. So we set up, and as soon as 7 a.m. hits, I crank the music, he laughed. I wake up all the neighbors. It's like, hey, it's 4th of July. Wake up, everybody. Time to party. This year's set list includes more than 40 songs from fun summer favorites like Miley Cyrus, Party in the USA, to feel-good classics like Here Comes the Sun. The Canby Farmers Market on North Holly Street kicks off at 9 a.m. 4th of July, while the music, car show, and most other festivities at the park are expected to run from 10 to 2.
Hey James, what's going on with the internet? The Wi-Fi is all spotty.
Well, is it your internet or the Wi-Fi?
What are you talking about? Aren't they the same thing?
Well, kind of, but no. You see, your home or office accesses the internet through underground fiber cables from DirectLink. It's actually your Wi-Fi router that converts that internet connection into an over-the-air signal for all your wireless devices.
Okay, you lost me at kind of.
Why do I even try? Look, you have seen like a box-looking device around the studio here. It's probably hidden under, it's under a thick layer of dust.
No, I don't. Oh, wait, is it that blinky flashy thing behind the stack of old pizza boxes?
Yeah, yes, it's the blinky flashy thing. That's the Wi-Fi equipment that connects your iPad, your PlayStation, and the laptop to the internet.
I bought that off Craigslist like 8 years ago.
Frankie, I think we just found your problem. Your Wi-Fi equipment is ancient. Electronics, they get old fast. And even when new software updates or faster broadband comes out, your old router just can't keep up. It's like expecting a Model T to outpace those new F-150 Lightnings.
Great. So now I have to make Tyler go buy, I have to go buy a whole new Wi-Fi setup? How does he, I even know what to get?
Look, I'm gonna make it simple. Just call DirectLink, man. Their professional grade Wi-Fi equipment is super affordable, and they'll manage the updates and the network security for you. They'll even help you install your new router in the perfect spot to get the strongest possible signal. You can visit directlink.coop/Wi-Fi to get started.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to make Tyler call DirectLink today. All right, on the Canby Conversation today, we're going to be welcoming back one of our previous guests onto the Now Hear This Canby podcast. Steve Nielsen is a longtime board member for the Clackamas Kennel Club, and he was the assistant chair for this year's dog show, which did come back this year post-COVID to the Clackamas County Fairgrounds. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you, Tyler?
I'm doing great. How are you? Staying cool, I hope.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, as we said, the Clackamas Kennel Club's long time show, one of the premier shows and with a long history here in our county, did return to the fairgrounds this past weekend, had some unexpected weather challenges to deal with on top of everything else with the pandemic restrictions loosening up. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about how things went?
Well, the weather was not ideal for us, of course. The heat was a bit of a problem, but we have had on other occasions, two occasions where it was over 100. So we did have a plan and knew what to do about the heat. So, Just to give you a little idea that, you know, this stuff doesn't happen by accident. The American Kennel Club requires us to have what they call a disaster plan. And I think I would call it an emergency plan instead, that we have to outline the steps we would take if we need to evacuate the site, or if there's lightning, or if there's high heat. So we had a plan going in. Unfortunately, you know, it was unfortunate that we had the heat the way it was, because it's not ideal. And heat, of course, can be very dangerous to people and animals if you don't have a plan to deal with it. And luckily we did. So we had no heat-related incidents at all.
That's good. Yeah. And I saw that posted as well. There were not a single case of heat stroke or even heat exhaustion, I believe, that was experienced by any of the folks or animals that were at the show.
Yeah, that's correct. As part of our emergency plan, we have on site during our show a veterinarian at all times who is there to assist the exhibitors if they feel a need that they need to have their dog looked at. Normally it's things like, you know, they've gotten something in an eye that needs to be flushed out, or the dog maybe has taken a bad step and is a little lame, but our veterinarian, Dr. Roth, was prepared to deal with any heat-related incidents affecting any of the dogs. Luckily, we didn't need to do that. In addition, we have a EMT on site from American Medical Response that is there with, I don't know what the term is, it looks like an ambulance, who is there and can deal with any emergency needs that a handler might have. And normally that would be somebody has twisted an ankle or maybe taken a little fall, but they did not see anybody with heat-related issues. We did have one exhibitor that did fall. Of course, that does happen from time to time at a dog show because the dogs have to be gated. So luckily, we didn't have anything unusual issue.
That's great. Can you tell us, Steve, a little bit? You mentioned the plan and that, you know, that there were things in place to address emergency situations and whatnot. Could you tell us more specifically about what you and the organizers did when you saw, obviously, the forecast was going to be pretty hot this weekend? You know, I saw photos. There's obviously a lot of shade that was set up. Maybe that was part of the plan anyway. But can you just tell us what measures were taken to try to address some of this heat and make people more comfortable?
Sure. As well, the planning starts long before the weekend, and luckily we have a really good partner with the Fairgrounds and Event Center that helps us pull off the plan. But we met with the Fairgrounds, I believe, on about June 8th, and we go over all of our setup requirements, what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, when it's going to be done, who's doing it. And at that time, we cover our emergency plan. We, of course, at that point, we did not have the high heat. Didn't look like it was going to be that hot. So, but anyway, when it became evident that it was going to be that hot, our show chairman, Ann Summers, and got together with Lori Bothwell, who's the executive director of the event center.
Yeah.
And we put together our plan. Now we have 32 large tents that we set up. Okay. We do that for every show. But in this case, what we did is we set up the 32 a little differently to take advantage of some of the natural shade. Plus, in it, we brought in an additional 6 10-by-10 pop-ups that we could use on a temporary basis wherever needed.
Oh, okay.
In addition, we have arranged with the event center to open up Clackamas Hall, which is an air-conditioned building that would be used for both the dogs and the handlers. We also opened up one part of the main lawn complex, which would be a cooling station for any of the judges or ring stewards that needed to step inside to get cooled off a bit. We also opened up the main pavilion, which normally we don't use for any. Normally, none of the buildings are used for dog. There are no dogs inside any of the buildings. So we opened that up to so that dogs could get in on the porch out of the direct sunlight. In addition, the Fairgrounds loaned us 6 large stock fans. Those are the type you see that they use during the fair to keep the large animals, cattle and such, cool. And we placed those around the grounds. Okay, we also had 6 floor fans to use inside the pavilion and in the Clackamas Hall and the cooling center. We had 12 swimming pools, the kiddie type pools that we used on the grounds, which were filled with water and ice. In addition, we had 5 10-by-10 misting stations set up so that dogs and handlers could get into the cool mist. And plus we had five additional Cobra misting things placed around the our grounds. And then as the sun angle changed throughout the day, we moved the tents and things to provide a lot more of the natural shade. And of course, we're very fortunate that the fairgrounds itself has a lot of natural shade that we could take advantage of.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. I mean, some of that sounds pretty jealous. I would have loved to have a few kiddie pools filled with ice in my yard. That sounds pretty great, actually.
Yeah, well, we were fortunate to have a good partnership with the fairgrounds. They ordered for us a ton of additional ice that was delivered about 7 o'clock on Saturday morning. So we were pretty well set up for ice. We had an additional 20 coolers placed around the grounds that were filled with ice and ice water, Gatorade, and that such. And it's just as a little extra touch, we had popsicles that we handed out throughout the weekend. So the number one reason for doing all of this is to ensure the safety of both the handlers and the participants that chose to show. Some people, of course, chose to, to stay home because they didn't feel that they wanted to be out in those conditions. And other people felt that if it was managed properly, that there would be no particular danger, because some of these dog participants, deal with high heat on, pretty much a regular basis throughout the spring and summer.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you find, Steve, that the dogs were taking advantage of some of those things, the pools, the extra water and whatnot? Were those pretty well used, I guess, during the hike?
Yes, they were all pretty well used. And the Clackamas Hall was especially well used because it was about probably 72 degrees in there. So it was substantially cooler. And a lot of people hung out in there when they were getting ready to show. Now, COVID was a big problem, but in this case, the COVID restrictions were really a good thing based on the weather, because to get our show approved by the county health people, we had to start in January putting together a package that would satisfy the venue and the county health people. So we canceled all of the events that kept people on the grounds for any extended period of time. We also canceled anything that took place inside Ely Arena. And we made the confirmation part of the show a show and go, which meant people were only expected to come to ringside 15 minutes before their judging time. And after the judging, if they weren't required for additional judging, they were to leave immediately. So there were substantially fewer people on the grounds on Saturday and Sunday than we would normally have had. So in some strange way, those COVID restrictions actually probably were a big benefit based on dealing with that hot weather.
Wow, that's nice to hear how that managed to be a good thing and help this unexpected situation. Your event, Steve, is just a one day on Saturday, was that right?
No, it's 2 days, Saturday and Sunday.
And can you tell folks who haven't been there before or seen it kind of how it works? I mean, you mentioned the tents. Do a lot of the or all of the activities happen inside those tents, or are there things that happen in the full sun?
There are, depending on what ring you're talking about, dogs are shown in a ring that is generally 50 by 50. Okay, at our show, at least, anyway, that would be the size. So the tenting is used to provide shade for the dogs while they are not gating, okay? So what happens is a class is called in, they're under the shade, then the judge examines the dogs one at a time, and then they are at one at a time, gate after they're examined, they're gated. So the only time they probably would have been in the direct sun would be the few seconds that they were actually gated. And it would depend a lot on which ring. Some of the rings are shaded all day. Some of the rings are shaded just part of the day. And what we do is, if like our ring number 11, we don't use it all because it has very little shade. And ring number 12, we only use until 10 o'clock in the morning because it does not have good shade in the afternoon. So we shuffle things around based on providing the most shade possible at any given point during the day. So the dogs spend very little time out in the direct sun.
That's good to hear. Steve, I know, and this was not specific to your show, one concern that folks talked about as the heat wave was hitting us was, you know, pavement and how hot it was getting. And obviously dogs don't wear shoes. And just how, you know, people being concerned about that or ways to address that if, you know, people wanted to take their dog out or go for a walk or whatnot, hopefully a shaded walk. You know, obviously, like I said, that wasn't specific to your show, but, you know, there is obviously the parking lot that people park in and then walk across to get to the fairgrounds. The sidewalks at the grounds are paved, some of them in sun, some of them in shade. So, you know, obviously a lot more about dogs than I do. First of all, is that a valid concern or is that a little bit overblown that dogs can handle that better than we think? And if it is a concern, how did you guys address it at your show?
That could be a concern. I guess, you know, the easy way to answer that is if people should come out and take a look and see how a dog show works. It's probably different than most people expect. But for instance, this year we rented a bunch of golf carts, and we had some people stationed to drive them from both the red and blue lots into the grounds. So if somebody wanted a ride, they just used the golf carts and they were taken to whatever area they needed to go to. So that, of course, would be a big help. Some of the owners probably don't have the best mobility, and we thought that would be a good idea in the heat so that they would not, have to walk a distance, because the fairgrounds we use probably, it's probably spread out over about 20 acres. So it can be quite a distance. So we use the golf carts to move dogs and people where needed. In addition, probably 50% of the dogs do not walk into the fairgrounds. They're transported by their owners in a crate, okay, on a dolly that has wheels. So a lot of them are moved that way, one for a couple of reasons. One, people don't want them to get dirty, okay?
Because, oh, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
So again, the real danger that you see is where you have the brand new black top that is extremely black. Now that can get very hot. The weathered black top, like you see at the fairgrounds, does not absorb the heat to the degree new black top would. So it is a danger, but again, we had no dogs at all that had any problems with their feet.
That's good. Steve, I want to ask, did you get comments, people asking you to cancel, or why didn't you cancel? And could you answer that question for us? When you guys were kind of looking at these forecasts and seeing the concerns and looking at how you could address it, was that something that you asked yourselves, are we going to cancel? And why did you decide to go forward with it?
Well, it'll be a bit of a long answer, but
that's okay.
The event itself, it says Clackamas Kennel Club, and that would be the events that happen on Saturday and Sunday. In addition, there are on Thursday and Friday 18 other events that take place. So, in looking at the whole weekend, the weather was not particularly unusual for Thursday and Friday. We've had numerous days where we've had that kind of temperature, which frankly, for us, is not a problem. Now, one thing I should have said earlier is we have two kinds of exhibitors that attend our show. One, you have the professional handlers, and that's how they make their living. And they travel from probably Canada all down the west, Western United States, maybe as far as Texas and Oklahoma and places like Westminster Kennel Club and the National Championship in Florida. That's one group, of course. They deal with heat all of the time and know exactly how to manage it, okay? The other group we have would be the local breeder owner handlers that live in this area, probably Washington, Oregon, maybe Northern California, that are also very experienced with dealing with these kind of conditions, okay? So we have a lot of people who understand how to properly manage their dogs. Now, most of the comments about canceling the show and things are on things like Can Be Now, where you have a lot of people who don't really understand the dynamics of what we're doing. Now, we of course always discuss the chances that maybe we should cancel, maybe there is a danger. But there's one thing is that all of the exhibitors can decide whether they want to come or not. So probably 35% of them decided they didn't want to come out on Saturday, and probably more like 50% decided not to show on Sunday. But the thing is, we had the other 18 events that took place on Thursday and Friday. So if we canceled, they would have to cancel their events also, even though they really didn't have the serious issue with the excessive heat that we were going to have on Sunday, especially. So it was kind of a group decision that we've done this before. We know how to do it. We've never had a problem. We have had events exclusively at the event center for 40 years, okay? And in that 40 years, we have had one dog have a problem with the heat, and that was a bull mastiff, and it wasn't warm. The dog was, had an inexperienced owner, and the dog got way too hot. Our veterinarian, Dr. Henson, had to step in and kind of take over. I don't know the correct term, they kind of tranquilized the dog and got him controllable so that they could get his body temperature down. And during those 40 years, we've never had an individual, either a spectator or a handler, have a problem with the heat. So we've had a lot of experience with high temperatures. So we just decided that in this case, we were going to go ahead and let the individual exhibitors decide for themselves whether they wanted to come out. They were made aware of what our plans were. Some of them decided that they would prefer to give it a try, and others decided they did not want to. But you know, and that's the way it should be. Everybody needs to decide for themselves. So I think the thing that's a little different now is you have social media where everybody can have an opinion, and their opinions aren't really based on, you know, facts. So that's like, you know, that dogs are going to burn their feet off trying to walk across the street. Well, unfortunately, that's not really true.
Yeah. And you make a good point, Steve, as well, not just your experience, but the experience of the fairgrounds itself and their, you know, very longstanding team in handling high temperatures and hundreds of animals at a time for the fair each year for over 100 years.
That's exactly right. It's something that that the fair has to deal with, too. And they have a huge variety of animals that they have to make sure that they're set up for. And we're really just looking at, you know, just our dogs. And we understand how to maintain our dogs in the heat. Now, you know, in a lot of cases, you find the farm dogs, they have to go out and work, whether it's hot or not. So a working dog is a dog that can go out and do its function in the heat, because, you know, that's what it's for. Almost all purebred dogs at some point in their, you know, in their development had a purpose, whether it be hunting or farm dogs or whatever. And then, you know, the toy breeds were companions. They were supposed to just sit in your lap. So.
Right. Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you, Steve, was just kind of what you thought of this historic day. You know, people are kind of talking about just the experience of it. What did you hear from folks that, especially, you know, as you say, folks that do this professionally and see all different kinds of climates and all different types of temperatures and settings? Did you hear folks saying like this was something, you know, that kind of remarking on how unprecedented, I guess I'm kind of getting tired of that word, but did you hear folks talking about how unusual it was, or that it was, you know, not so bad, or I've seen worse, you know, we did a show in Death Valley or whatever?
Well, there was a full range of comments. Most of them that I've seen, all of them were positive except one. But I think a lot of people coming out of COVID were just appreciated the ability to get out and see some of the people they haven't seen for over a year, and just, you know, get out and try to get back into a little bit of a routine. And the comments in general, you can read them on our page or other pages. They were all very complimentary of the steps that both we took and that the fairgrounds took to make sure that the dogs were comfortable and were not in any danger. The same with the handlers, or make sure that they were able to maintain themselves in an appropriate manner. And I was impressed that we got through the very challenging weekend with virtually no problems at all, including nobody lost their temper.
Wow, yeah, that is more impressive than anything. Not counting social media right now, just kidding. That's a different standard, but well, Steve, I really appreciate you having you on, and thank you for your time. Is there any thing else that you'd like to add, or maybe a way that folks can learn more about the Clackamas Kennel Club and what you guys do?
Well, we have both a Facebook page and we have a regular website. If they want to know more, they can take a look there, but I would say next year, hopefully with much better weather. We are June 24th, 25th, and 26th. It's a free event, and I would tell everybody to just come out and take a look and get a little better understanding of what, you know, the process is, and they can, you know, they'll probably see some things that they haven't seen before. Hopefully we'll be back to normal and we'll have Barn Hunt and some of the other events that are a little more exciting to watch, but I think it's a good chance for people to come on out and see what this is all of about, rather than just getting their information secondhand from, you know, people who don't really have any experience.
Yeah, yeah, it is a cool event. It is a cool organization what you guys do, and just see, you know, anyone who likes dogs, this is a great way to learn more about them and really see unique characteristics of all the different breeds, or many of the different breeds, showcased to their fullest potential, which is really cool. Steve, thank you again so much for being on the show today, and take care and stay cool, my man.
Sure. Thank you.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months. Sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Well, friends, we're going to draw this episode of the Canby Now podcast towards a close with this episode of Canby Then. This time it's brought to you by Retro Revival, not your average antique shop. They're open daily, and you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant Street in downtown Canby, or connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. They say all's fair in love and war, but that doesn't necessarily mean all's love in war and fair. Indeed, a war of words was fought in 1908 over control of the fledgling Clackamas County Fair, and Canby was the winner. The fair had started in Gladstone and was a smashing success, but enterprising folks in Canby thought they could do better, and they had just the spot in mind, a beautiful 40-acre plot on the east side of town on land once owned by Supreme Court Chief Justice Aaron E. Waite and still held by his descendants. Led by the Canby Development League, Chairman R.S. Coe, and 23 other league members, the town was ultimately successful in bringing the fair to Canby, where it would remain for the next 112 years, at least. A groundbreaking was held in late July 1918 to begin construction on the fairgrounds' buildings and a first-class racetrack, and it was a festive occasion. Local officials came out in droves to view the beautiful grounds and make speeches under a stand of drooping fir trees. The mayor of Canby, J.F. Mitz, had proclaimed the day a local holiday, and many downtown businesses closed their storefronts in honor of the momentous occasion. Canby's Silver Comet Band met visitors at the old train depot, which I guess back then would have been the new train depot, and whisked them through a grand processional to where the ceremonies would be taking place. Numerous delegates from surrounding communities were there to, quote, rustle on the sidelines and make all the noise as needed, as recorded by the Oregonian. Judge Grant Dimmick, whose later exploits would reveal him to be one of the most sinister rogues in the county's history, exhorted his listeners to do all in their power to make the fair a success by talking and working for the enterprises in season and out of season, according to the Canby Tribune's chronicling of the event. Another early fair booster, Professor Theodore Gary, went even further. Mr. Gary advised everyone to boot up, and if we hear anyone talking against the fair, to take him out and hang him, or something to that effect, the newspaper noted. His remarks were timely and well-received. Well, no hangings were recorded, but the work on the new fairgrounds came together splendidly. Out of the Waite family's rich farm and forest grew barns, arenas, stadiums, and outbuildings, some of which still stand to this day. Unlike the 1907 fair, which had been headlined by a gaudy carnival from out of town, which included a mask ball, Mardi Gras, freak show, and family feud-style contests, the centerpiece of the Canby Fair would be its sparkling new horse racing track. The half-mile racetrack has been placed in order during the past few days and is pronounced by experts to be one of the finest tracks in the state, the Oregonian declared. WH Council is directing the grader, steamroller, and sprinkler at the fairgrounds, and the racetrack will be in first-class condition. Cash prizes of up to $1,000 were awarded to the fastest horses, thanks to liberal contributions from Portland businessmen and across the state. Not that it was all about speed. Slow trotting was also a popular form of racing entertainment in those days, and several were scheduled for the three-day event. A five-mile relay race for pupils of the local schools was also considered an interesting feature. Other prizes would be given to top show performers for horses, cattle, sheep, swine, poultry, vegetables, fruit, and all kinds of farm products. Awards will be given for ladies' textile products, bread, cakes, pies, preserved fruits, etc., the Oregonian said. 50 special prizes will be awarded for the best of exhibits of every kind of farm, garden, or horticultural product. The most popular day was Friday, which had been designated Oregon City Day, something that had also been done at the 1907 fair. According to an earlier article, the entire town promises to pay a Canby a visit and enjoy the raptures of country life for a day. Well, that might have been an exaggeration, but not by much. 3,000 souls visited the Clackamas County Fair that day, and almost a third of them from Oregon City, which in those days had a population of just north of 4,000. There were so many folks from Oregon City, a special train was on hand just to take them home at the end of the night. The attendance was far greater than was anticipated by the fair officials, a newspaper later recorded, and was due partly to the perfect weather and in no small measure to the fact that nearly 1,000 people came from the county seat to make a boost for the old Clackamas and her fine products that filled the big pavilion. The display of products of the soil were amazing in variety and quality, though not so numerous as the previous year due to a late frost. Nevertheless, the mammoth vegetables and luscious fruits grown by the family farms that thickly encircled the community and its fairgrounds attracted wide attention. The horse races, though, were widely considered to have been far superior to the previous years. They were more and better horses in competition, nearly 500 in number, and the crowds poured in from all directions to see them pound the dirt. The fair wrapped up with an exhibition baseball game, with a hometown team hosting the Spantons from Portland. With one of the night boys on the mound and pitching a no-hitter, the Canby Bats got hot and spanked the visitors 16-0. That's what I call an old-fashioned thrashing. The fair had found its permanent home, and in the rich Canby soil, it was prepared to grow and grow. That, however, is a story for next time on Canby Then. Well, friends, as always, thank you for listening. I'm James Walton. Have a great day.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, Do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Camby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Camby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yeah, heck, you were just a baby back then.
Wait, what?
And they love to give back. They've been members of the Camby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Camby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Camby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Now Hear This Camby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Camby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Camby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Camby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.